I declare bankruptcy!
I congratulate you on your imagination, but this is a court of space law, not a theater.
Tax mentis incendium gloria culpum etc. Memo bis punitor delicatum. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal.
How is this a fair trial? Our lawyer is a Morty.
It's not fair. You have no rights, and he's not a lawyer. We just keep him here because he's fun. Look at him go.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 132. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your other host, Andrew Torres. How you doing, Andrew?
I am doing fantastic. I am super excited because today's show is going to be the Thomas Show. It is all about you, and I could not be happier.
Now, before people rapidly turn off their radios or whatever they listen to this on, that doesn't mean I'm doing anything. It's still Andrew's doing everything, but it's a great story. It's a sort of a personal news story in a way. In fact, Andrew told me that there's stuff he discovered that he can't wait. Like, it's going to be like a big reveal. I have never been more excited for an episode. Turns out my high school the one that I went to is going through like a God's Not Dead 3 or 4 maybe now scenario. And in real life, like, this is a real thing. And Andrew looked into the case. I'm so excited. So can't wait to get to that. Before we get there, though, we just wanted to put out a quick word. We are still doing patreon.com/law if you want to support us. I know we went through some Patreon nonsense, but that is still that's still good law over there, patreon.com/law. And we're working on people who listen to my show know I added a subscription option on my website. We're kind of working on that for Opening Arguments as well as a measure of insurance against future Patreon action, because they've shown some really curious decision making. But for now, everything's the same. Thank you so much for sticking with us. We'll enjoy. Oh, you wanted to hand out an Oprah Winfrey style handout to our
I do. I want everybody to look under their seats. if you have been a Patreon, if you have been a Patreon supporter of the show, we wanted to thank you. Right, we know there was a lot of uncertainty. Hopefully, we demonstrated our trust to you that we are always looking out for our patrons, for people who support the show. We will never let somebody impose unilateral costs on you. We begged you to stick with us and help figure this out. And a lot of you did. And as a show of our thanks, what we want to do is we want to give away this past year of Lawed Awful Movies to you. So that's a $2 patron perk. It's going to stay a $2 patron perk going forward, right? Because we got to, you know, give away stuff to people who are supporting us at that level. But if you're a patron at any level of support, we are going to make active, when you download the show, all of the previous Lawed Awful Movies episodes. Sorry. All of the previous Lawed Awful Movies episodes, including Jury Duty, including Madonna's Body of Evidence, including the crazy Sovereign Citizen video we did. It is hours and hours and hours of holiday themed entertainment. So if you've got like a 37-hour bus ride that you've got, great. Cue them all up, and you will laugh yourself hoarse on the
Don't get on any new Amtrak lines, but other than that, if you've got any long trips, sure.
So that's our way of saying thank you to the patrons who stuck with us. We really appreciate it. We hope we've continued to earn your trust. We hope if you've been on the fence that you'll kick us a buck. We always make that pitch. But if you stuck with us, we wanted to give you some free shows. So there you go. Merry Christmas.
It's not quite a car, but it's as good. It's as good.
I think so. I mean, what's better? A car, you've got to put gas in it. You have to pay the California sales tax on it. No, you don't have to pay any sales tax on free
lot awful taxes movies, so. On lot awful movies.
There you go.
All righty. Oh, God, I cannot wait to get to this vein segment. I've never been. I'm just so curious. But before we get there, segment one, here we go. Thomas is appointed to the federal bench.
Have you ever tried a jury trial?
I have not.
Civil?
No.
Every lawyer is tempted.
Criminal?
No.
Bench?
No.
Not only to eat forbidden fruit, but to become the snake.
State or federal court?
I have not.
Why am I persecuted?
Yeah, I think everyone who listens to the show has probably heard Senator Kennedy from Louisiana questioning Matthew Peterson, Trump's nominee to the federal bench. It was 5 minutes of really perfection on the Senate Judiciary Committee. We actually used our crack editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, put together the intro that you just heard here. He used it in episode 131. So folks have had a lot of exposure to it. And I got the question, right? Most people, particularly most people listening to the show, were rightly appalled at Peterson's lack of experience. But I got the question on multiple occasions from our listeners of, you know, there seemed like a couple, right? They were asked, you know, what's younger abstention and a couple of other things that seemed like a little insider baseball. How hard were those questions? How easy a time should Matthew Peterson have had in answering them? And so I thought what we would do is I have not shared these questions with Thomas at all. I'm going to ask him five questions that are the same level of difficulty as the five questions Matthew Peterson couldn't answer.
All right, I'm going to start making excuses right now because the problem with this is, because everyone, you know, they said this to me as well. Oh, you could have been a federal judge. Yeah, the thing is, I can answer multiple choice law questions. I don't know any terminology. So if they're all like, you know, because this was like a motion in limine or whatever, it's like, I don't know. I have to confess this to you right now, Andrew. I have tried zero cases. I've tried zero cases. So we'll see how I do, but I'm looking forward to it.
We'll see. We'll go through it. And again, I am completely springing this on Thomas, so he has much less opportunity to prepare.
That's another part. Were I going to testify in front of Congress, in front of a committee
possible I might prep you beforehand.
I might bone up on some basic terms, possibly.
Right. Well, we're going to try it. We're going to see how it
goes. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. All right. First, let's start off with, this is the only one that is the same from these two. Thomas, do you know what a motion in limine is?
Well, that's one of the ones that they asked, right? And the only reason I know is because it was asked. So I recuse myself. I'm already more qualified than Trump legal appointees because I have ethics. So I'm going to recuse myself from this question but I'm pretty sure if I caught the right thing here that it's motion in limine. It's to introduce something, what was it, before that the jury doesn't see or something? Or what was it? Was that it?
You're close. A motion in limine, at the outset of every trial, lawyers from both sides will file motions in limine. This happens in every trial I've ever had. You don't typically have it in super small cases, but the reason why this was so appalling is that if you're going to sit on the federal bench, you will hear these in literally every trial that comes before you. And it's derives from the Latin root. I mean, it means limit. And what you do is you move in front of the judge to limit testimony and you say, judge, I want you to exclude the other side's attempt to introduce Thomas Smith as an expert for the reasons that are set forth in my attached motion. And then the judge will rule on the motions in limine and say whether you can call Thomas Smith to the stand or not. Happens in every single federal trial.
Oh, I see. So it's like before everything gets going, you're trying to like hamstring the other side. Okay, let's get rid of this.
Right.
Let's see. Okay.
Yeah. So that you don't have the like surprise elements that we see on our bad, lot awful movies, right? Like if you have a completely unqualified expert, then the standard for introducing the expert, which was another one of the Matthew Peterson things, not a question I'm going to ask you, But you know that because you've taken depositions of the expert, and the lawyers brief that up before trial starts.
So
and they
this say, sounds hey, look, incredibly yeah. basic. This sounds like something
incredibly basic.
Any person who's going to be a judge should know.
Yes.
To say the least.
Exactly. All right. So recusal. We have a non-answer for one.
I recuse myself despite not even remembering the right answer. So I'm glad that recusal. I'm 0 for 0.
Yes. All right. Question number two, Thomas. What is injunctive relief?
Ooh, I know what injunctive relief is. That's when you get a judge to stop something or to pause it, temporarily while you evaluate it, and you need to show the probability of success on the merits. And, you might remember it from such episodes as Trump's immigration ban. Hi, I'm injunctive relief. You may remember me.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Injunctive relief is when the court orders somebody to do or not do something. And it is contrasted with ordinary damages. Usually what you get in court is money. So,
right.
You know, it in a typical like breach of contract situation, you pay me $1,000 to paint your house. I don't paint the house. You can't go to court and get an injunction for me to paint your house or become your butler or, do any other wacky thing that you see on TV. You get the $1,000 or you get whatever your measure of damages is. That's what courts are exist to do. We have focused on the likelihood of success on the merits prong because in most of these cases,
right? Yeah, I was just going to ask. So to clarify, injunctive relief is not necessarily is it something that you could get in a normal like the full length of the process still happens.
Yes,
but you get injunctive relief rather than like some monetary relief. Is that what you're saying?
Or in addition to.
Okay, so it's given me a kind of a false impression just because we only ever talk about it when it's like, okay, we're trying to head this off at the pass and get somebody to stop it before the proceedings go through.
Right. We typically talk about temporary restraining orders and preliminary injunctions, which are a subset of the sphere of injunctive relief. So injunctive relief is the larger universe of whenever the court is ordering people to do things or not to do things instead of giving out money.
Okay. See, you would very quickly be able to tell that I am not qualified to be a judge. Now, relative to what, reality should be, not relative to the new reality in which anyone can be a judge. I don't even know.
Right.
I don't even need any experience, but okay. So I half credit on that one.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Question number three, Thomas, what is a deposition?
Deposition is when, now who takes deposition? That's just getting the statements from the witnesses ahead of time and figuring out what they know. But it's also on the record and you use it later to compare to their testimony. I don't know. Is that enough information, Senator?
Yeah, that's exactly right. A deposition is in the civil trial system is part of the discovery process. It is on the record, but there are only lawyers and the stenographer in the room, and is designed to elicit information from parties and witnesses who have testimony that may lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. So that's absolutely right.
That's a very basic question. Frankly, I'm Senator Torres. I'm insulted by how basic that question was. Of course, I know what deposition is.
I will try and do better on the next one.
I've been appointed to be a federal judge. You don't think I know what deposition means? Come on.
So this is a tricky one. We have talked about this on the show, but the question is, Mr. Smith, what is removal?
You mean in a legal sense, I take it.
Senator. Yeah, I don't mean what you're going to just do the to noun, this room yeah. when you exit.
Removal. I without any context, I don't know, I don't remember like specifically what part. Could be removing anything from anything. I'm sorry. I don't know. You know what? I've learned a lot here today, Senator Torres. I'm not qualified to be a judge. I apologize.
So removal is the act of taking a lawsuit that has been filed in state court and transferring it or removing it to federal court. And here's how that happens. We have talked about some of these lawsuits where the plaintiff will allege both violations of the U.S. Constitution or of federal law and also state law claims. Right. So, for example, that came up in the Zarda versus Altitude Express claims. Right. In the Zarda versus Altitude Express case, where the plaintiff alleged claims under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is a federal lawsuit. So therefore, you get to be in federal court. And then the question was, could that plaintiff have also alleged state law claims? And they elected not to because they wanted to tee up the case in order to have the Second Circuit adjudicate the federal law issue. But in an ordinary case, you might bring both sets of claims, and ordinarily the plaintiff is the master of her complaint. You get to choose where you file as long as it's an appropriate jurisdiction. You get to file it in state court, but a state court defendant might look at it and go, there seem to be federal issues here that are better addressed by a federal court. So I'm going to file a notice of removal and I'm going to remove the case to federal court.
Right.
And then the federal court gets to argue about whether it should hear the case or whether the opposite of removal is remand, whether it should remand it back to the state court. Right.
Right, right, right.
So that's removal.
I actually probably would have remembered remand. I wouldn't have, for some reason, removal is too general of a term. Like my non-lawyer brain is like, remove what from what? I don't know. But yeah, I remember
right,
now.
Right.
I remember Senator Torres.
thanks for like refreshing your
recollection. I feel like, relatively speaking, I'm doing quite well. I would say I'm at least leading in the clubhouse for all the nominees. But
there we go. All right, question number five.
I've gotten half a question out of three or four, so that's good.
You've gotten one and a half.
Questions out of four. Okay, here we go.
Question number five, what is abstention?
Abstention. I mean, I know what to abstain means, but I don't know. I can't remember if abstention is this another procedural thing that I'm going to forget the exact context of? abstention. I can't remember.
Okay. So these were, I'm combining of the questions at the end that were asked of Peterson. And again, because I think it would be a little bit unfair to ask you, you know, to define Pullman abstention and to define Younger abstention, that's ridiculous for a non-lawyer. But the abstention concept itself is really, really straightforward. And it's something that judges have to deal with all the time. So when a case is removed to federal court, and it has both federal and state law claims, one of the grounds for remanding the case back to state court is on the basis of abstention, right? Mm. And reasons for abstaining are it would be in the interests of justice and in the interests of judicial economy to have the state court rule on the state court issues if doing so would obviate the need for the federal court to rule on the pendent federal issues, right? That is specifically, as you narrow down to the question of constitutional law, the doctrine of Pullman abstention says, if the only reason you're in federal court is because there are allegations of constitutional law, right? But resolution of the state court issues will eliminate the need for the court to resolve the constitutional law questions, then under the Pullman case, the federal court should abstain, should send it back down to state court, let the state court do its thing, because then there's no need for the federal court to rule on those constitutional issues, which then, you know, could be, you know, advisory or unnecessary or whatever. And I should add as a corollary to that, that federal courts, this is implicit. It's why I asked the removal question first, because you have to understand removal before you understand what abstention is. When you have mixed federal and state law claims, a federal court can adjudicate state law claims by applying state law, right? And we've talked about this before. If I sue you in California, but the court determines that Maryland law applies to your case, then the court doesn't transfer the case from California to Maryland. The court just says, okay, this court will apply Maryland law. This court says, you know, we're capable of doing that. Judges are smart people. We can look it up. We'll apply Maryland law. Same thing happens in federal court. So a federal court could say, we are going to apply federal law for the federal law claims. And then for the pendant state law claims, we're going to apply the law of the state in which those claims arose. So, you know, let's say North Dakota law, right? But implicit in all of that is the idea that while federal courts can do a perfectly fine job of applying North Dakota law, or while the California courts can do a perfectly fine job of applying Maryland law, it would be better to have the state courts do it, right? It would be better to have North Dakota apply North Dakota law, and it would be better to have Maryland apply Maryland law. So if you can do that, then as a judicial policy, it has, you know, been longstanding settled policy for, you know, for decades in this country that the courts will defer to a state's adjudication of its own state law claims if it wouldn't otherwise prejudice the litigation. Right? Hmm. If it would, you don't want to let Maryland decide federal law. You don't want to let North Dakota decide federal law. You want the federal courts to rule on the federal claims. But if they don't have to, they should abstain. So
makes sense.
I wanted to go through that.
So that sounds like some legally judgy thing that a judge would need to know. I don't know why you're asking me. But sure.
It is why, because the funniest bit of Kennedy interrogating Peterson was at the end. It was the bit that only lawyers were laughing at, and I wanted to share the joke with everyone. So at the end, he says, you know, Mr. Peterson, can you tell me what younger abstention is? No. And younger abstention has to do with civil rights claims. So it's the only one that I would sort of give him a pass if he'd taken a crack and defined abstention the way I did generally and then, you know, messed up because there are three or four different specific abstention doctrines. But then he says, can you tell me what Pullman abstention is? And that's the one that I defined fully. And Peterson says no. And Kennedy very dryly looks up and says, y'all get that a lot in federal court, you know. and it's true, and it was hilarious, and it's true, you know, for
professional. It wasn't great delivery, right? But yeah, okay.
Yeah. Sure. it was funny for lawyers because lots of cases get to federal court because they are removed, and then the initial response by the plaintiff who has had their case removed, who tried to file in state court, has had it removed to federal court, is to argue in their petition for remand that one of the various abstention doctrines should apply. So again, it's not quite as basic as a motion in limine, but I have probably filed a dozen briefs in my life where I've had a case, and again, keep in mind, I usually represent defendants in lawsuits, but where we've had to argue either for or against, you know, a various aspect of abstention on in federal court to either send it back down to state court or to keep jurisdiction over the case. So something absolutely as a judge that it just is basic required knowledge.
So, Senator Torres, I will definitely bone up on my law books. Yeah, how do you I love afterward, it was like, I can't believe, you know, I'm sad that my whole career is based on, you know, been judged based on 5 minutes of my worst whatever. Are you buying that as any sort of, can you have just a bad 5 minutes or does he truly just not have any friggin' idea about the law?
I tried to pick questions that I thought were the rough equivalent in level of difficulty of the questions that were asked. And you got 1.5 right out of 4 and instantly grasped, you know, the 2.5 that, you know, you didn't get. Yeah, anybody can have a bad day. Anybody could be nervous. Not knowing these things is not something that any lawyer who has ever tried a case would forget. Right. I mean, it's not quite at the level of like, can you tell me who the defendant is? You know, like what the word defendant means. But
well,
it's
that's
not
why
that
you're
far
the judge
off.
And I'm the law talking guy.
Exactly right. It is as if he said, I'm sorry, I'm just the law talking guy. And, you know, right. So it's bad. And Peterson has withdrawn his nomination. Yeah. So
well,
so good
Senator
job,
Torres,
Senator
I move
Kennedy.
For a bad court thingy. That's
all right.
Yeah. All right. I failed, but you know, that's what you should expect from a non-lawyer. And by the way, from a non, like it's not even as though this should be just an average lawyer. I mean, if you're getting appointed to a federal judgeship, you should be pretty exceptional, shouldn't you?
Yeah. And let me be very, very specific here, right? If I were preparing a federal judicial nominee with no trial experience, the kinds of things I would expect that person to have to answer are some of the difficult questions that have come up in our more difficult bar exam questions, right? Like, how are you applying the hearsay rule? How are you applying the various exceptions to, offering opinion testimony versus lay testimony, right? The types of things, because the reason is, when you're the judge, you're listening to the trial unfold in real time, and you're going to have to rule on objections. And if you don't know, you know, the basic rules of the federal rules of evidence, and know them really, really cold, then the lawyers are just going to run roughshod over you, right? Like, and in particular, in a case which has an experienced lawyer on one side and a pro se defendant on the other, or a less experienced attorney on the other side, like that, when the lawyer knows that the judge has no idea what they're doing, I mean, that's just a recipe.
It's going to be like when we're all about Simpsons references. It's going to be like when they think Bart's a genius because he switches with Martin's test, and then he goes, and they all like steal his lunch because they're like, "Hey, I'll trade you one molecule on Mars gravity worth of this for whatever." So like, it's like that. Like the lawyers who know their way around it will walk all over him.
If I was trying a case in front of Judge Peterson or Brett Talley, right, who we talked about a month ago, whose nomination has been pulled thanks to the fine work of Andrew Seidel, who was on last week. You know, I would do things like make bogus objections in the middle of the trial, right? Like, objection, that's highly prejudicial to my client, right?
It
would turn into a lot-awful movie, because why not, right? Like, yeah. I stand a reasonable chance of, you know, buffaloing my way through this judge who very obviously doesn't know what the federal rules of evidence require. I would be nonspecific, right? Rather than saying objection, that's highly prejudicial to my client, which I might try that one, because, you know, we have talked about there's a rule that says if the unfair prejudice outweighs the probative value,
right,
you know, you can restrain it. But like the fact that it's prejudice, right? Like every bad piece of evidence is necessarily prejudicial to your client, right?
I would just say objection.
If it's fairly prejudicial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would just say objection, motion in limine.
Right.
So whatever one's
objection, Your Honor, obviously he can't introduce that, right? Like, and just look at the judge and be you know, and stare him down and wait for him to be like, well, right, of course. Yeah, everybody knows. Yeah, this is plainly not admissible.
We need to get to my high school. Enough of this unimportant drivel. No, that's great. I and this guy shouldn't have been appointed judge. So that's the conclusion.
But you're closer. That's my takeaway.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three. There's a magic move.
Ah, speak for free. That's all I pray. Until tomorrow, cross the Milky Way.
Yeah, And the chief comes in on a ski horse and he's like, and then I'm like, and the dragon comes in.
All right, Andrew, this is so fascinating. I saw a friend of mine sent me this because it is the high school I went to is being sued God's Not Dead style over a biology class. Now, I got limited details. I haven't read the case like you have. I'm excited to find out what twists and turns await us. But the teacher involved is not a teacher I had, but the wife of a teacher I had. So I have some knowledge of the teacher, but it's been a few years.
So just for people who are listeners of OA who are closer to my age than to yours, you went to Bret Harte High School?
Yep.
Is that right? Yeah. And I had to look. It's spelled with an E on the end of
Everyone
H-A-R-T-E.
Thinks of the wrestler, yeah. You nerds.
Yeah. Brett the Hitman Hart. He was part of the Hart Foundation. That's a shout out for my buddy George, who is the world's biggest 80s WWF wrestling aficionado that I know. So that was the first thing I thought of.
No, this is Bret Hart as in the he was like Mark Twain, except not. Or something. And by the way, the elementary school I went to was Mark Twain Elementary. Bret Hart was like an author, but he was also, I think he was kind of a fraud or something in some ways. I forget the story, but it's not the wrestler.
So there's a kid. This is just unfolding. There's a kid named Grayson Mobley, who's a sophomore at Bret Hart High School. Public school, we should say. All of this isn't an issue if it's a private school for reasons that we've already been through.
Right.
And he is a creationist, right? He was at an evangelical elementary school before transferring into public school.
Does it have the name of that?
No, it just says local evangelical primary
school. Oh, okay. Because there was one called like Chalcedon or something. Anyway, go on. I was just curious if I would recognize the name of it.
So Mobley says he wants to, in his sophomore biology class, wants to raise objections to the theory of evolution, proposing an alternative narrative, namely intelligent design. Right.
Oh my God.
And the teacher, Ms. Jer Maurer. So this is the wife of the teacher that you had.
Yeah, Maurer.
Maurer. Okay, it's spelled Maurer, but maybe it's pronounced
they pronounce
Maurer.
It Maurer. It's no big deal. All right. You wouldn't know because you didn't go to Bret Hart wrestler. High school.
I didn't. So, has said, this is a science classroom and you're not going to do that.
Here's first thing I want to ask you there. Hold on. Because is this one of those things? Because they have some quotes, you know, alleged quotes of what she said, like, keep your God out of your, you know, like all this outrageous stuff. Is that this the kind of thing where you just say whatever you want and then it's assumed, like you just assume it's true for the purposes of, do we dismiss this case? And then later on, she would be able to say, hey, I didn't actually say that. Because I don't believe the quotes that they're saying she said.
Yeah, that is exactly right. In a complaint, you allege specific facts, and those facts are treated as true until demonstrated otherwise for purposes of
Because what's one of the quotes? I think it says, she said, this is a place of science. Get your God out of, you know, just this outrageous God's not dead dialogue that I know. There's no way that happened. Anyway.
The allegations are that she said on the first day of school, leave all ideas and notions about God outside my classroom, and science is fact and religion is faith.
There is no possibility that she said that. But anyway, go ahead.
So now let me say, if a public school teacher were to say that in a classroom, that would be a problematic statement. Right. Yeah. That would be something in a situation like that. What you would have happen is a group like the Alliance Defending Freedom. We've made fun of them before. They were the legal counsel in the Trinity Lutheran case, would send a letter. And the letter would say, you may not display hostility to a student's religion in a public high school classroom. And they would be correct. And the teacher would be disciplined. Mm-hmm. And the teacher would have to come in and say, hey, I said something that might have seemed like I was attacking your religion. If I did, then I apologize. What I meant to say was, this is a science classroom and we will be discussing the scientific theories that are appropriate for this class, namely the theory of evolution. And if you have religious objections to the theory of evolution, this class is not the place to discuss those. That's what I meant to say. Right. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing to say for reasons that, you know, we're going to talk about. But so the allegation, right, hostile to religion. And keep in mind that the relief that Mobley wants is not an apology for saying nasty things about Jesus, but he wants to be able to derail a biology classroom by bringing up a whole bunch of Discovery Institute talking points that he's downloaded off a website, right? The school, quite sensibly, has said, no, we're not going to let you bring in creationist literature and read from it under the guise of giving a question in class. That's not how classes work, particularly in high school. Right. So Mobley's lawyer has said they're going to sue. Now, he threatened this board hearing was on December 4th. The The threat was, if you don't reverse the school board policy and allow my client to talk about intelligent design in class by December 7th, I'm going to file a lawsuit. I have searched the courts, and to the best of my knowledge, they have not yet filed the lawsuit. Usually we wait till there's an actual complaint before it, but I couldn't help myself on this one for reasons that you will find out. So knowing that there isn't a lawsuit, but there are allegations from that public hearing, I did what I would have done had there been a lawsuit filed, which was I looked up the lawyer, right?
All right.
So the lawyer is named Greg Glaser, G-L-A-S-E-R.
Can't wait.
And I'm going to give you a little bit of a spoiler. He's a crazy person. he's not just slightly crazy. He's not like just ideologically motivated. Like I happen to disagree with him because he's a crazy person.
Oh my God.
And this probably is going to be
probably par for the course for my hometown. It's probably just, you'll describe things. I'll be like, yeah, that's just normal everyday life in my hometown.
So I'm going to link his website. You go there. And the first thing you see is that Mr. Glazer's practice. And again, this is what you do when people get sued, right? This is what I expect when I threaten to sue people. People look me up. They go to my own, oh, look, like he practices in the area in which he's threatening to sue me. You go to Mr. Glazer's website and there's a 30-minute video on there where he's being interviewed about how he advises for sale by owner real estate transactions, right?
Huh.
That's the bulk of his practice.
Does he know what a motion in limine is?
He's tried cases. I'm going to go with yes.
Okay.
But then he also has on his list, below the interview about real estate, he's got constitutional as a button, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of weird, but okay, fine. Let's click on it. You click on constitutional, and this is what the page says. It says, I offer legal services to individuals willing to promote fundamental constitutional ideals in support of justice, liberty, and sustainable living. And then he gives the subcategories. Health freedom, especially vaccine rights, sovereignty, separation of powers, and fundamental rights. Now, I want to stop right there and say, sovereignty, separation of powers, and fundamental rights, those are not categories of constitutional law, right? Like when you say, I'm a constitutional lawyer, like you would say, I litigate free speech issues, right? I litigate church separation issues, right? Saying I litigate sovereignty issues is saying nonsense, is saying baloney, right? But let's start with the first one, vaccine rights. So I should also point out, in addition to being a crazy person, and by the way, Mr. Glazer, when you listen to the show, please feel free to file a defamation lawsuit against me. I can't wait. I am 100%.
It's just more content for us.
Yeah. Confident of my ability to prove in open court that you are in fact a crazy person. And notice I'm not giving you a specific diagnosis. That is a statement of opinion, not fact. You're a crazy person. Anyway. So, of course, as you would expect, when you go to his vaccine rights page, he's an anti-vaxxer, right? And
right.
He helps represent people who want to get exemptions to the California mandatory vaccination law. I've pulled this question because people might not be convinced yet. You shouldn't be convinced yet that he's a crazy person. You have to listen to the rest of this. Question, are vaccines good for everyone? Answer. Vaccines are literally, quote, drugs, end quote. I am not a doctor, but I think vaccines should only be for people who desire to inject themselves with drugs. I agree with the doctors who say that clean living and natural immunity and wholesome food and traditional care is good for us. Ultimately, the reason that people hand over their children to the injections of the pharmaceutical industry, by the way, interesting use of the English language there, is because of fear. Is that fear warranted? I don't think so. I think we should strive towards developing natural immunity and intelligent natural remedies. All right. So that's neat. And I'm going to link his blog.
Vaccines are drugs and therefore should only be used on people who want to inject drugs into them.
Yeah.
Wow. I've never heard that.
So, okay. So he's got this, and I'm going to link his blog. He's got multiple blogs. I do not know why, because
one wasn't enough.
He doesn't update any of them frequently, but I guess he didn't want his,
he probably,
you know,
forgets
real estate
that he made
peanut butter
last
getting
one
mixed up with his, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. He probably forgets that he made the last one. Is like, oh, I need to make a totally rambling, crazy blog. I forget. And he like forgets the login information for the last one he made, and then he makes a new one.
I think that's probably right, because I was going with he didn't want to get his, you know, real estate chocolate mixed up with his anti-vax peanut butter. But like, none of these are updated frequently. It's weird. He also has a love for the ampersand that I have not seen since my high school poetry teacher, Gary Blankenberg, way back in my sophomore year of high school, who like always would write poems.
Is that his real name, or you just don't want to curse on the show?
Yeah. Gary Blankenberg. So shout out to Catonsville High School peeps who remember. All right. So he's got this weird anti-vax blog. Does he have anything else that's crazy, you ask?
Yes, I do ask.
Oh, yes. So he also maintains, and all of these, by the way, are linked off of his firm website. Right now, look at, and in fairness, right, you go to my firm website, you get linked to opening arguments, and you know, you can certainly cull things that I have said on opening arguments.
Yeah, they're virtually the same as saying we need clean, natural, natural immunity. I don't know how that works with some of these things, but okay.
So he maintains obviously he's a religious nut too. He maintains a blog called logicalhierarchy.com. And the logical hierarchy is Bible studies, non-denominational, with a focus on mathematics and logic. Right. So, all right, what? I think mathematics and logic, I think, you know, okay, symbolic logic. I'm going to read some dense philosophy papers. I'd like to read you a little bit from his post, September 22nd, 2015, the number 19.
Oh, fantastic.
Why do we want to know about the number 19? Yeah, because in biblical Hebrew, one name for God is Allah, A-L-H-A. I've never seen that before, but yeah. Well, yeah, whatever. I'm going to take his word for
him.
It. Right?
He seems reputable.
Using simple gematria, I love that. Where Aleph equals one.
So don't worry. Nobody, two. There's no complicated gematria, everybody. We're just simple gematria. Simple
entry level gematria 101. The total of these letters is 19. So Alha equals 19. And then 19 is a super special number.
And prime number.
I'm just going to read, right? When this is, and I want to emphasize, I can only tell you, I'm going to link this. You can verify this for yourself. I am neither adding nor removing. There are no ellipses. This
well,
is word
it's
for
important
word
to not add or remove any words, because when we do elementary gematria to add up the numbers of it, we need to have it totally intact. So I'm glad you're keeping the language intact.
When two, dragon number, tries to divide seven, messiah number, the triumph is given to the Messiah to be born into three and therefore sit at the right hand of the Father, that is nine, at the top of the hierarchy. The Messiah also receives eight, 3 + 5 = 8, duh. Oh, sorry, that duh is my commentary there.
Yeah.
The Messiah also receives 8, 3 + 5 = 8, representing the new world/age created after seven, this world/age. That was a challenge to parse out.
I feel like you ruined it with your editorializing. It would have been fine, but since poisoned the well. I'm just trying to learn, Andrew, and you're, you know, your negativity.
All right. No commentary. He asked the rhetorical question. What else does Rodin's diagram mean in Hebrew? Mm-hmm. I'd like to learn too. Well, in Hebrew, 369 spells GVT. Which is a mysterious expression. A human could say it means majesty, just as readily as she could say it means connection, pride, friction, growth, or expansion. Or if you read it backwards, 963, TVG, the meaning is equally mysterious, as one might say it means pride,
also,
voice, friction,
why is six
violence,
afraid
or crown.
Of seven?
Now, your comment, you wanted to learn. There's one more sentence here. Or two more sentences, sorry. As these expressions manifest themselves in our universe, we expect and make relative choices to fulfill the destiny of our story that was born from the beginning as word. As long as there is a one in the equation, then zero will always be kept from triumph.
I cannot wait for this person. By the way, this is Trump's next appointee to the federal.
So, okay, all right. So he's anti-vax. He's engaged in numerological gematria and thinks 19 is a magic number, and that the one prevents the zero from triumphing, which, given that he composed this on a computer that is entirely, you know, composed of ones and zeros in its processing, whatever. Okay. You might ask yourself, but surely he has relevant legal interests, right?
Well, we know he defends separation of powers because that's something.
Yeah. Says on his website that he is also the founder of an organization that I cannot find anything about. I have Googled. I have looked, called Everyday Currency. I have some guesses what it might be about, but they have zero website presence, zero legitimate Googleable website presence. I don't know. They might be all over the dark web. I have no idea. But he also founded something called the Civil Action Network, and that I can access, is www.civilactionnetwork.org. And that does not instantly appear to be something that was created by crazy person. It has a little drop down tag for referenda, right? And referenda, that makes total sense. Right?
That's because, a real word.
Yeah, from living in California, California has the most referenda, which are ballot initiatives that are placed on the ballot that voters get to vote on in every election.
Are we about to add up the numbers that make up the word referenda and then see how, or no, we on to actual legal stuff?
Oh, it's so much better than that. So I clicked on the referenda tab. Right. And I was like, OK. And the mouse over, by the way, in referenda says, hammer out some legislation with fellow CAN users. Right. The Civil Action Network. OK. So what? Right. What referenda might Mr. Glazer want to put on the California ballot?
Prop 8.
There's one tab, one item comes up on the referenda page. It is entitled Earth Constitution. I'm going to read you a little bit.
Earth Constitution?
From Mr. Glazer's proposed Earth Constitution. Article 1, Section 1. The United Nations is hereby abolished, and its authority to work justice is transferred to a new governing authority with jurisdiction across Earth, which shall be called Earth Government. The individual humans of the world hold and maintain legislative authority over the Earth Government. All right.
Okay. But good start to Earth
bit,
Government.
A little bit odd to introduce in California, but, you know, okay. I'm a globalist. I can go with it, right? Yeah, Article 3, Section 1. The judicial power.
The California voters have decided. Earth Government, everyone.
But it's going to have to be ratified by the citizens of the Earth. But okay. I guess it gets introduced in California.
Yeah. You the judicial start power.
This is my favorite one because I think there's a good loophole here for you. Mm. Article 3, Section 1, the judicial power for the Earth Government shall be vested in one Supreme Court, operating above seven regional courts. Each continent represents its own region.
Uh-huh.
So I just want to point out, if you to get to seven, this means there will be a Supreme Court for Antarctica. So I think Thomas Smith. I feel like
that one's not going to get as much, you know, court traffic as some of the other court circuits.
You know, probably not. But
I can't wait for our first injunction that comes from Antarctica, like a penguin, just injunction on something we're doing here in North America.
Each Supreme Court shall have 12 judges, each elected for a 10-year term, and under Section 8, the personal salary of an elected judicial officer is 100 ounces of gold per year. So... So I just want to point out, we could get a dozen people to be the Supreme Court of Antarctica. We could get 5 or 6 people and 6 or 7 penguins and distribute out 1,200 ounces of gold.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1,200 ounces of gold. And
that might be a lot. That might be a lot of money. Ounce of gold. Isn't ounce of gold like $1,000 or something?
So the spot price of gold per ounce as we record this is $1,281.80. So
it's a good living. Means, I like how his first like concern when writing a treatise on a new Earth government is like, but how much are the judges going to make on when they're appointed for tenure. That is, I love that. The detail. How long is this document that you're reading?
You can, it is, it has 9 articles, but includes with it section 21 of Article 8 says the following codes attached to this constitution shall apply to all jurisdictions on earth as legislation passed pursuant to Article 1. And that is penal code, civil code, environmental, evidence and trial procedure. So all of these would be, you know, are thousands and thousands of pages, right? You would want to replicate.
Is he just adding in? So that's him like cut and paste in the U.S. code or like elements of the U.S.?
He doesn't define what these are. I mean, maybe. I spent a lot of time.
Oh, like he's got some other attachments somewhere that he's.
He might, but I can't find them.
Okay.
But I like it will also include the Worldwide Jubilee Declaration. So that's probably shorter.
Oh, man.
But my favorite provision and the reason for that.
How do you pick a favorite, though?
Oh, I know.
Antarctica Court is already up there.
Antarctica Court is high. A penguin can eke out a pretty good living on $128,000.
What are you doing with gold?
Do you have
in
any
Antarctica?
Idea how many sardines that will buy? No, but the reason for my including the Van Halen classic Love Walks In the intro for this, thank Brian for putting that together on short notice, is Article 8, Section 16, which I have to read to you.
Okay.
Intelligent extraterrestrial individuals.
I knew it. I knew we would. Right when he started with Earth Court and Earth Law, I was like, there's going to be like a Vulcan law or like a. Like a Carillion, whatever the alien, the weird alien names, it's gonna come up. Okay, here we go.
But by birth, within the, intelligent extraterrestrial individuals may become citizens of the Earth by birth within the territorial borders of the Earth, right? So ET anchor babies. Adoption. So again, ET. Or long-term acceptance into the family and home of any citizen of the Earth. Status as a political refugee recognized by the president upon arrival to the Earth.
Who's the president? Is there an Earth president?
I wanted that. Excellent point. I look through this document.
I think I found a hole. Hold on. I think I found a problem with this document.
This document uses the word president twice and only in this section. It does not tell us who the president is. The head of the Earth government is and I'm sorry I have to say this, Article 2, Section 1, the executive power of the Earth government shall be vested in a chief caretaker. The chief caretaker shall hold office for a term of 4 years. Votes to elect an executive may be submitted at any time during the spring of the appropriate year in the 4-year cycle. The chief caretaker shall publish all Earth government laws in the languages used by the nations. So, no, there's no president in this document. So there is maybe there will be a president whose sole job it is to decide whether intelligent extraterrestrial aliens are political refugees. But and you might president.
I mean,
there's
a lot of penguins with nothing else to do in Antarctica Court. So they could probably, if we want to outsource that to Antarctica Court, then they could make that determination.
I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I thought maybe he first called it president and then changed it to chief caretaker later and just, forgot to in this passage. But no, it says status as a political refugee recognized by the president upon arrival to the Earth or by work visa as the president may issue at the discretion of the executive branch. Then it says the chief caretaker and Earth government judiciary shall have the power to regulate citizenship and the Earth's territorial integrity, including by intergalactic cooperation in matters of law enforcement to ensure that individuals entering the Earth are not fleeing justice. So I guess I'm
tired of people coming to this planet, aliens coming to this planet, fleeing. They're not sending us their best aliens, Andrew.
They've got calves the size of cantaloupes. Yeah.
I like the part where you have to, if you're born in the borders of Earth, like how do you define the border? Is that orbit? Is that, what are the borders?
It's that level of insight that is going to make you an outstanding Supreme Court justice for the territory.
Well, I feel like before, this is a good start on this document. But before we adopt it, I just think we ought to, We got to go over it a little and just make a few edits. A few, you got your red, red felt tip pen.
You might.
A few pointers.
And I should add, the environmental caretaker anchor baby extraterrestrial aliens does not contradict in his mind Article 7, Section 1, which says, towards the goal of respecting our Creator in heaven, the lawful and traditional nation of Israel remains fully sovereign, and the King of Israel may choose whether to comply with this constitution at any given time and space.
And space? What is that?
I'm pretty sure that Israel does not have a king. I maybe this is like a crazy dominionist.
There's a prime minister, isn't there?
End times thing. Yeah, I know. I'm pretty sure they don't have a king. So that was also neat. So, okay, all right. So he's anti-vax numerology and wants to nationalize aliens with work visas. Maybe he's nevertheless correct about the law, right?
True. Yeah. It would be a logical fallacy to dismiss his considered legal argument just because he's writing a new Earth constitution that involves alien visas and stuff like that.
And again, I want to be clear. I am not taking this out of context. This is not alien visas in the way in which a lawyer would use that term. This is intelligent extraterrestrial individuals. Yes. So what's the argument? The argument he's making is that Mobley has a right under a case that you may recognize called Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District, 393 U.S. 503. It's a 1969 decision. That case was about students who wore black armbands to school in protest of the Vietnam War. And the Supreme Court said, the most famously quoted bit from the opinion is, students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate.
Mm.
And the court said that because, and in particular, because of the lack of findings that it would interfere with the educational mission, that the school couldn't prohibit students from just peacefully wearing, this was 1969, black armbands at school to protest the Vietnam War. The case is not categorized because the Supreme Court hadn't really fully articulated what today we call the viewpoint discrimination doctrine. But it would very clearly fall under that sort of jurisprudence today, right? The idea that what the school is doing there is, under the guise of this is going to be disruptive, saying, no, you know what, like, you're just talking about kids wearing armbands, and they're entitled to do that. They're entitled to make a political statement.
But let's remember, this was the North American Circuit Court. Right, what did is there agreement?
Yeah, what did Antarctica say about it? Under Tinkers, but okay. So, you could say, all right, well, could the argument be extended out? So, you know, Mr. Grayson has not shed his right to practice his religion at the schoolhouse gate. And surely if kids can wear black armbands, then he can interrupt biology class by yammering about how the bacterial flagellum is irreducibly complex, right? No. If you go to page 509 of the opinion, which I'll link, this is where the Supreme Court in Tinker actually articulates what the test is, right? And they say, in order for the state, in the person of school officials, to justify prohibition of a particular expression of opinion, it must be able to show that its action was caused by something more than a mere desire to avoid the discomfort and unpleasantness that always accompany an unpopular viewpoint. Certainly, where there is no finding and no showing that engaging in the forbidden conduct would materially and substantially interfere with the requirements of appropriate discipline in the operation of the school, the prohibition cannot be sustained. So, in the present case, the district court made no such finding, and our independent examination of the record fails to yield evidence that the school authorities had reason to anticipate that the wearing of armbands would substantially interfere with the work of the school or impinge upon the rights of other students. So that's the real test, right? And here it is abundantly obvious that having this creationist kid yammer on in class about intelligent design and, well, if there's, you know, if we evolved from monkeys, why are there still monkeys, is going to substantially interfere with the work of the school, namely teaching kids evolution, and impinge upon the rights of other students. this argument is a nonsense argument. And if Mr. Glaser files the lawsuit alleging that it is a free speech issue based upon Tinker, then even with the discriminatory animus implied by the quotation marks, right? Even if we assume that that's true, and even if the teacher expressed a hostility to religion, that case is going to fail. There is no free speech right to interrupt a biology class with questions that you think.
Well, but hold on. I've seen the movie. The way we resolve this is there's a debate between the biology teacher and the student, right? And then if the student wins the debate, then I guess high school becomes church or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Then everybody has to text "God's not dead" to 100.
Yeah. And then there's cheering. I know there's open cheering in the courtroom. I know that much, but I'm not.
But I do want to point out the California courts, in the event that this were to go forward, they would very likely draw guidance from the Kitzmiller versus Dover decision that's been celebrated in our circles. But I want to kind of emphasize why we talk about these Trump judicial nominees. The Kitzmiller decision is a decision of a single judge of the U.S. District Court for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, Judge Jones, that was issued in 2005. It's not binding law in California. It's not binding law outside of the Middle District of Pennsylvania. It is a very, very persuasive authority because of the comprehensiveness of the opinion. But a court in California, a court anywhere else in the country, is perfectly free to say, to take up an intelligent design case and say, you know, petitioners urge us to allow intelligent design. Defendants point us to Kitzmiller versus Dover. But in our judgment, that case is not well founded. Instead, we think intelligent design is a perfectly viable blah, 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 blah. And if you have an ideologically motivated judge, you know, that Kitzmiller is a double-edged sword, right? It shows the power that one federal district court judge can wield. Now, again, part of the strength of Kitzmiller is its comprehensiveness, its thoroughness, the fact that it is so well-reasoned, the fact that it goes down kind of every avenue. And it speaks directly to the argument that Glaser and this kid are making in this case, which is, I'm going to quote, this is page 738 of the Kitzmiller decision, the decision in the section entitled Intelligent Design is Not Science. The court says, ID, intelligent design, is at bottom premised upon a false dichotomy, namely that to the extent evolutionary theory is discredited, ID is confirmed. This argument is not brought to this court anew, and in fact, the same argument, termed contrived dualism in a previous Supreme Court case, was employed by creationists in the 1980s to support creation science. The court noted the fallacious pedagogy of the two-model approach and that in efforts to establish evidence in support of creation science, the defendants relied upon the same false premise as the two-model approach. All evidence which criticized evolutionary theory was proof in support of creation science. End of quote. We do not find this false dichotomy any more availing to justify ID today than it was to justify creation science two decades ago. So
why
that's
are
where
still
California
talking
court
about defunct old American law, yep. Andrew. Earth law. Get on it. This is not, I don't know why we're wasting these people's time with American law. That's we got rid of that.
That is where the California court is going to come out. They are going to say intelligent design is not science. Advancing intelligent design in the classroom interferes with the pedagogy and the rights of the other students to receive an actual education in a public school.
Well, I will be appealing this decision to the Penguin Circuit. You can await my...
Well, let's keep track of this lawsuit and figure out how the Penguins decide.
But I am going to make some calls and talk to people because this is hilarious. You know, this is my mom taught at this school for 100 years. I don't know how many actual years, but something like 100, probably 35 years or something. She was the Spanish teacher. She knows everybody. I'm gonna ask her. But here's what I'm worried about. This will be some like family friend. that it'll turn out that I've met this person and like hung out with them and they just never talked about Earth law and space alien visas in my presence or something. I'm dreading that.
I want to make, and again, because I've invited a defamation lawsuit, I want to make what I am describing as a wholly uninformed and totally speculative guess here. But I'm thinking if you met Mr. Glazer, like I think within 10 minutes, like of meeting him, you get the like sovereign citizen, you know, pay us in gold. And did you know the extraterrestrials walk among us? I'm just thinking he's the kind of person that can't,
to
that
be
can't
fair,
go 5 minutes.
In full fairness, I'm not sure if he thinks extraterrestrials walk among us or he's just making sure he's prepared legally.
That's right. He could just be the most
anticipating,
right? It should. He's that. There we go. We figured it out. I
you
issue
don't want
a full
it to
and formal retraction.
And not be
no,
prepared
no, no. Yeah,
and not have it, applicable
it's
Earth law.
Good. It's good to button up every possible circumstance that could happen. So if Israel happens to get a king sometime soon, or space aliens happen to land and apply for work visas, I'm convinced. I fully retract my prior statements.
We need to make sure the space aliens aren't wanted in their system. So we can't get that guy from A New Hope in the bar that's like, I have the death sentence in 12 systems. Like, he can't come and naturalize over here. That's just something that, you know, that he thought of.
And again, I want to point out in specific the use of the term intergalactic cooperation, because inter means between two. So this is not just, this is between two galaxies.
Oh,
right?
Okay. So it's not just as though, okay, we discover life on Mars. You know, this is even Alpha Centauri, or wait, galaxy. No, that's even, who knows?
Right. Wow. Yeah, this is the Andromeda Galaxy is the closest one, which is, you know,
we're going to meet eventually.
Millions
all right,
of, light years away.
This is my new favorite episode of all time. I cannot wait for the spinoff show where we fully go into, you know, there's a new Thomas and the Book show happening here. We're just waiting to happen with this treatise.
If you want us to draft the rule because it's not included in there, I guess, because the supreme power of the judiciary is vested in the supreme courts of the various continents, then like in American history, what that means is we're going to have to create inferior courts to handle, you know, local penguin law issues.
Yeah, but what happens when the circuits disagree? Is there a supreme earth court? Did he get that far or no?
No, there is, but the Supreme Earth Courts are, each continent represents its own region. There is one Supreme Court operating above the seven regional courts.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see. Wow. Well, that is, thank you so much for looking into this. I'm seriously going to talk to some people and see if I, you know, what's going on here, if I can find out.
All right, report back, because our patrons, our listeners are waiting, and I need to, if you've got an in, I mean, we could get appointed to the Supreme Court of Antarctica.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what kind of questions you'd have to answer for that. You know, like it won't be motion and limit. It'll be, you know, if an extraterrestrial is wanted in there, you know, those kind of questions. Okay, well, that is excellent. Thank you so much. It is now time for our Patreon shout outs. And I believe, Andrew, you can start us off here.
Thank you to Heather Loveridge, to This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict, to, as far as you know, Michael Schaefer did not collude with Russia. That's true. Roger Metcalf and the International Waters, my favorite Pink Floyd cover band. Rhonda the Dork, our first patron Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Dave, co-founder of the Florida chapter of Thomas's Goon Squad Nichols. I love that shout out, but Dave, I think it's time to pick a new name, man. Jim Grove, Ian and Allie, Matthew Vernon, Violet Page Hall, Jeffrey Maynor, the Wayward Willis podcast, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Squick Thinger, Aaron Grady, C6 Sarah, adopt a homeless camp and oppose questing and orging. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Philip Stromberg, summer is coming. Go to campquest.org to sign up for a camp in your region. Soggy Pants, Sammy, Sam Danow, and too busy to think of a new name. Thank you all so much.
I love the shout out names. It's my favorite part. And thank you to Greg Sullivan, Malika Chandler, Jesse Studd is my favorite lawyer, Andrew is a close second, Tricicular Manslaughter, CampQuest.blorg, 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 Rebecca Smelzer, Adam Lenda, If You See Ken, oh yeah, this one. If you see Ken, it gets me every time. Like literally every time he gets me with this one. If you see KYOU rocking, rock and rolling up Purge Mountain, Keith Davies, quick, someone teach Mueller how to cast Zone of Truth. Jared is sipping on Yodel Mountain Vineyards and Yuletide Mullered wine. RaymondSpecialties.com, custom survey gear. Cecil and Tom are better than Thomas and Andrew. Well, that's very unkind of you to say, but okay. Run Like a Girl. Polly Shake. Horseman Fights for the Week. Soul.
That's good.
Sakashite. Stock, hashtag Stop Brexit. Hashtag Save the NHS. Hashtag Make Britain Great Again. Frederick Elstromer, Cody Bond, Mitchell, Eric Johnson, Science-Based Vulnerable Transgender Fetus, Michael Rops, Secular Saint, Impeach Roger Goodell. I love that one. And finally, Zabby, thank you so much for being our Hall of Famers. You guys are the best. I look forward to, if we are going to do a website thingy, I look forward to that. But for now, everybody's on patreon.com/law. And you're going to have a lot of awful movies coming at you soon. And also, of course, you know, as Andrew said early in the episode, we are making those lot awful movies available to all patrons of any level. The old ones, the back catalog. We hope you enjoy it.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And it's time to try to answer a question. I feel like I'm on a bad streak on these, aren't I? I don't think I've got.
Yeah,
right
you're down a couple, but... That still no problem. I feel like you're gonna get right back up there today with all of our deep dive into Antarctic law. So
yeah. I do
are you
feel
ready?
Especially prepared today.
Tad asked Steve if he could borrow Steve's boat for a day cruise. Steve agreed, but instructed Ted to stay inside the bay. Ted cruised around the bay, then, because the ocean was so calm outside the bay, crossed a mile of open ocean to the Blue Oyster Cult Oyster Bar on the docks at Santa Patagonia Island. I would totally go to that. While Ted was docked, another boat passed the dock at an illegally excessive speed, and its wake washed onto Steve's boat, causing water damage to the upholstery of about $150. Ted returned the boat directly to Steve without further incident. What, if any, recovery can Steve have against Ted resulting from Ted's use of Steve's boat? And I want to point out this question alternates between Tad and Ted. There's a typo in the question.
Yeah, I feel like that's a legal loophole. Can't I just say, or a mistrial, bad court thingy?
Yeah. Ted is also spelled in all lowercase letters with colons and brackets around it. It's, you know, it's a sovereign citizen thing. All right. Yeah. What recovery can Steve have against Ted resulting from Ted's use of the boat? A, Steve can recover nothing because Ted was not responsible for the water damage to the upholstery. B, Steve can recover the cost of repairing the upholstery because it was damaged when Ted took the boat out of the bay. C, Steve can recover the value of the boat because Ted was in dominion and control of the boat when it was damaged. Or D, Steve can recover the value of the boat since Ted violated his instructions about staying in the bay.
All right. This is, again, I think this shouldn't even count because of the Ted-Tad typo. I think that invalidates the question, so I should just get it right. But well, you know, so we'll award me at 1 point, but just for the sake of the show, I will, you know, try to answer. I think I'll eliminate A, Steve can recover nothing because Ted was not responsible for the water damage to the upholstery. Yeah, I think I'll eliminate that. I feel like he can recover something here. And all right, here's what I'm gonna do. This is impossible because this is a weird question. I hate this book. But I'm going to do one of those weird eliminations where I eliminate C and D because it cannot be true that Steve can recover the entire value of the boat because of some water damage. If that's true, I'm moving to a different circuit. I'm going to go to Antarctica circuit because this Earth Court law is nonsense. So I'm going to eliminate C, Steve can recover the value of the boat because Tad was in dominion and control, and D, Steve can recover the value of the boat since Tad violated his instructions. So I'm just going to, it'll be one of those, but I don't care. Those are wrong anyway. Even if it's right, it's wrong. And I will say it's between Steve can recover nothing because he's not responsible, Tad was not responsible, versus Steve can recover the cost because it was damaged when Tad took the boat out of the bay. I'm just going to hope it's the common sense answer and go with B. I think he can recover it from Ted because Ted was in control. And then I think it's kind of, if it's on Ted or Tad, I don't know if we have like a Jim Carrey, Me, Myself, and Irene situation with the Ted name, but it's kind of on Tad to recover from whoever damaged the boat, I think. So that's what I'm going to guess, but I have absolutely zero confidence in this answer. Good thing it's a mistrial because of the name typo.
All right. Well, we will find out on Tuesday if you've gotten back on the right side of bar exam questions. As always, if you want to play along with Thomas in Thomas Takes the Bar Exam, you know how to do that. We announce our episodes on Facebook and on Twitter. Simply share that along. Use the hashtag TTTBE. Give us your guess and give us your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and then shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
You know, yeah, play the game. It's so fun. We love it. I would say that the only thing that makes me feel better after definitely getting this question wrong and knowing nothing about the law is I got to hear this episode, which is my new favorite episode. So that is worthwhile. I don't care because I am more interested. You know what? This U.S. law thingy you talk about, Andrew, is not long for this world. So I don't even care that I got the wrong answer. It doesn't matter. I'm studying for Earth law.
Feel free to let us know if you're playing TTTBE with Earth Law as well.
Yeah, we'll have to specify. With that said, thank you so much, everyone, for listening, for playing the game. Thank you most of all to our patrons at patreon.com/law. And also thanks to our Andrew at andrew.com/Andrew. And wow. Well, I'll see if I can get any inside info on this.
Can't
report
wait.
Back. All right.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.